supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, I've been seeing couples now for nearly 40 years, and frankly, most couples struggle with intimacy, but I have never heard one person say, I have difficulty with intimacy. It's always the other person. I've even had men come in to say they want to work on intimacy issues, but almost all of them have come in because their wives have sent them in. Well, here's the deal. Intimacy is about being known for who we are. No, not just our strength, our courage, and our wisdom. Intimacy is about sharing your vulnerability, your fear, your neediness, and even your narcissism. But dare we open that door? Well, today's show is about fear of intimacy. I'm joined by Lisa Firestone. She's a clinical psychologist and director of research and education for the Glendon Association, where she studies couples and family relations. She's the co-author of Conquer Your Critical Inner Voice, Creating a Life of Meaning and Compassion, and Sex, Love, and Intimate Relationships. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Later on in the show, by the way, during our last segment, we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about what happened in Norway last week when 98 people were killed. But we're going to start off talking about fear of intimacy, and we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Is this an issue for you, or is it an issue for your partner? And maybe it's been an issue for many of your partners. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. So, Lisa, let's start off understanding the concept of intimacy. I look at my relationships with my patients, and one would consider that a very intimate relationship. And sometimes my patients report it's the first truly intimate relationship they've ever experienced. So how do we understand what it is?
Well, I think that's, you know, what you said is really true, that often a psychotherapy relationship really is an intimate relationship. And by that I mean a close interpersonal relationship where two people are really in emotional contact with one another.
What does that mean, emotional contact?
It means that they're really relating, that they're attuned to and paying attention to what the other person's feeling and thinking, and that that person is doing that with them as well.
So my opening of the show, the introduction. So everybody says their partner's afraid of intimacy, and the complaint, like I said, comes almost uniformly from women. So are we talking about people in denial, or are we talking about a guy thing?
No, I think this is a problem that both men and women have. I get the same thing. People read my father's book, Fear of Intimacy, and they say, oh, you've nailed my partner. You've gotten them exactly right. And I hear this from both men and women, that they feel their partner has this problem. But like you said in your opening, they rarely recognize that they may have a part in that or that they have a problem themselves. I think when you said, you know, sometimes over and over again your partners have had this problem, I think when people have that experience, that it's worth starting to look at how this might really be an issue in them.
When it happens over and over again, is it about expectations?
Well, no, I think it's often about choosing partners who defenses fit with our defenses. And so while when you ask people what they're looking for in a partner, they name all kinds of very positive characteristics, what we're actually looking for on a less conscious level is somebody where their way of dealing with the world or their defenses fit with ours. And in that, we are often looking the same partner over and over again, even if we've had unsatisfying relationships with that type of partner in the past.
So as an old family therapist, I would raise the question that when we look for our partners, are we looking for someone who can help us heal the wounds of our family, or are we looking for someone who can help us repeat our family dynamics?
Well, I think that that may be both. I mean, I think that we're looking for somebody where their dynamics fit with our family's dynamics. And I think this is not a very conscious process, but it definitely is one that we find people who are either going to treat us the way we were treated as a child, or we take the role of the parent and treat them the way we were treated as a child. But that, you know, it doesn't mean that we can't work out those issues with this partner if we become aware of them.
And the awareness is the big deal here, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's a very big deal. And again, awareness that, you know, we may have a problem with intimacy as well as our partner, not just that our partner does, because that's the awareness that more people report.
You know, one of my mantras that I say in almost every one of my talks is that the hunger to be known exceeds the hunger to be loved. That being known and accepted for who we are deep down inside is really what we strive for. And I'm not sure the words "I love you" have any validity unless we truly feel known.
Right, because who are they really loving if they don't really know us? If we're put up on a pedestal by our partner, for instance, you know, it doesn't really feel like being loved because that's not necessarily who we really are. And so I think that's really true. And, you know, that has to do with partners really knowing themselves and being honest with themselves, but also really getting to know the other person and see them for who they truly are.
Yeah, easier said than done, huh?
Yes, much easier said than done.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Lisa Firestone about fear of intimacy, something that is pretty universal. Would you agree, Lisa?
Yes, I would. And I think that, you know, often what people do to deal with that fear is they form a fantasy of connection with each other, which speaks to what you were talking about a real connection where you feel seen. And if you're fit into somebody's fantasy bond or illusion of connection, they're not really seeing you. They're sort of fitting you into a slot.
Yeah, I want to hear more about that fantasy bond. But if you're just tuning in and want to join the conversation, if you've got personal experience with difficulties with intimacy, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. What are you looking for in an intimate relationship? How do you define intimacy? And how does your experience of intimacy fit with your childhood, I wonder? Again, that's 888-477-9499. You know, Lisa, we're talking about openness here, and one of the problems is anybody willing to open that door all the way? I mean, after all, terrible things really could happen. I mean, the more I expose myself to you, the more at risk I am.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have a fear of that kind of vulnerability, and they see it as very dangerous to be vulnerable or completely open to another person. But, you know, I think paradoxically, when we're really vulnerable and open, we're the most likely to get what we want in a relationship. And so in a way, it's the safest place to stand. But what I find is that often people are, you know, sort of saying no to themselves before their partner might and not expressing wants or feelings that they have because they feel like they won't be accepted, and in a way, not letting their partner really know them, and then they never really feel loved because they don't feel known.
So we're caught in that loop, huh?
Yeah, I think we are, but I think it's because we think of vulnerability like we're still the helpless child that we once were, and that if we're vulnerable, you know, something terrible is going to happen. But again, opening ourselves up and being really vulnerable in relationships actually gives us the best chance of success.
Well, the truth of the matter is, I'm listening to you, Lisa, and I'm hearing shame throughout this. I mean, we as a culture have a great deal of shame around vulnerability. It's called a weakness. I had somebody tell me, this is a person of authority who had some health issues, and I said, why don't you let your staff know about your health problems? And she said to me that if my staff knew about my vulnerability, they'd cut me off at the knees. Well, you know, that is not an unusual position, that vulnerability means weakness. There's shame around vulnerability.
Yeah, I think that's a common feeling that we experience. And, you know, I think this is where the male part of the issue fits in, because I think it's even though the person you were mentioning was a woman, you know, I think for men especially, vulnerability is, you know, also culturally seen as weak. And so there's, you know, a supporting, you know, barrage of thoughts about how that's weakness, or if you show vulnerability, you're going to be hurt or taken advantage of. But, you know, sort of, if you think about it, a kind of paranoid orientation toward life of, you know, having to protect oneself at all times. And I do think, you know, another thing that comes into play is, you know, critical inner voices or negative thoughts about vulnerability, which are really prevalent and interfere in relationships.
Yeah, and I do want to talk about that inner voice, and we're not talking about hallucinations. We're talking about something that's pretty universal. I'll tell you one of the many things I've learned. I don't know if our producer Jennifer mentioned to you that I'm a quadriplegic, and over the 30 years of being in a wheelchair and asking people to help me with various things, you know, I've learned that, you know, what real strength is being comfortable with your own weakness, with your own vulnerability. And once you have that, then you're safe. Then you have that well-being that all of us are really looking for.
Right. And no, I didn't know that. But yes, I agree with you completely that being able to ask, you know, and let ourselves, let other people help us, that's, you know, something I think a lot of people really struggle with.
Let's go to the phones. We'll start with Tim. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi, Dan. I can hardly hear you, I'm afraid.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
Oh, that's much better. I'm calling because I heard you say that people who come with vulnerability issues are always blaming the other person, and God, that's just what I wanted to do when I called. So let me tell you a little bit, and then tell me how.
No, wait a minute. You're cured already.
No, I wish I were.
Oh, okay.
Listen, I'm 62. I'm a widow. I'm a widower. I married a widow. Before we got married, when we were making love, I found I was a bit more broad-minded than she, and I like to communicate back and forth. I like to know what's going on with the other person. She evidently didn't. We had a long discussion about that. For me, it was a deal-breaker, and she said she would try. We made love wonderfully for like a year, Dan. It was just tremendous. And then recently, she told me she was just being accommodating and really didn't enjoy it at all. I kind of felt like I had the rug pulled out from under me. I kind of felt like... one of the things I had done when I started the relationship, I love to hear you say it, was I told her she would know everything about me, the good things and the bad things, because that was the only way I could really know that she cared for me. So, I mean, I was pretty open about everything. So, I feel like I was intimate. Wait, talk
and,
to me.
And you were intimate?
I'm nervous, too. And we're getting a divorce, because, you know,
why?
What I want to say in my heart of hearts is that she was afraid of that much intimacy. But I kind of almost don't trust my own judgment after hearing what you say. I mean, was I not intimate there?
Why are you getting a divorce?
Because she wants one.
Wow.
And because she doesn't really want to go to counseling, and because she went to a Christian counselor who told her that the way I wanted to make love was just perverse and filthy, and honest to God, Dan, all I wanted to do was, like, talk, you know, I would say things. I don't know what I can say on the radio here. I don't want to get too personal.
Yeah, well, you're getting me a little nervous if you go further, and so...
It really was not, I mean, it was, help me out here.
Well, yeah, I guess that's why you called.
Yeah.
So what would you like from us? How can we help, Tim?
I guess I'm one of those people who accuses the other person of not being intimate, and I guess maybe what I need is, can you give me some things to help me be more intimate? I mean, am I really...
Well, Lisa, I don't... Let me go first, okay?
Sure, go ahead.
I would suggest that you call the show maybe because you're hurting, because you're in pain. And my gut reaction listening to you, Tim, is that the issue is not about intimacy, that the issue is about compassion, that maybe she didn't have compassion for you, maybe you didn't have compassion for her, and maybe you don't have compassion for yourself. And here you are second-guessing yourself. And what I would wish for you is simply to have compassion for the man that suffers. And have compassion for the soon-to-be ex-wife who's in distress, who's uncomfortable. It doesn't have to make you right and her wrong or vice versa. Just two people.
No, that's very true. I mean, I'm just discovering how really different we are.
Right, right. And compassion for the heartbreak that was your marriage. Lisa, do you have any thoughts for Tim that could be helpful for him?
I mean, the only thing I would wonder about is in selecting this partner, if there was, you know, it sounds like there were some signs that it might be difficult to be as close to this person as you wanted, or that, you know, and not, that's not a judgment on either of you, but it's just, you know, one thing you might want to be open to thinking about in terms of the future.
Well, I'll tell you what, Tim, you know, first of all, I appreciate your call. I appreciate your openness, and I do wish you healing in this process. Lisa, you bring up an important issue, and that's mate selection and what that's all about. We've got to take a short break now, and when we come back, I want to talk about mate selection. I want to talk about that critical inner voice we alluded to earlier. We're talking about fear of intimacy with Dr. Lisa Firestone. She's a clinical psychologist who studies couples and family relationships. She's written a great deal about intimate relationships. She's also the founder and contributor of psychalive.org. That's one word, psychalive.org, and a blogger for Psychology Today. So we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk with Lisa. And then after in our third segment, we're going to talk with Dr. Jim Coane about the impact of the tragedy that took place in Norway. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
Do you have love, time, or resources to help one child? Bethany Christian Services, a national nonprofit adoption agency, envisions a world where every child has a loving family. Since 1944, Bethany has provided adoption and foster care services, licensed in more than 30 states, including Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. To learn ways to care for vulnerable children in our region and around the world, 800-215-0702 or bethany.org. Bethany Christian Services supports WHYY.
WHYY-FM is expanding our reach into New Jersey. Now when you go down the shore, you don't have to leave your favorite public media provider behind. Tune in to WHYY-FM at 90.9 in Philadelphia, Camden, and Princeton, 88.1 in Berlin, 89.9 in Manahawkin, 89.7 in Atlantic City, 90.3 in Cape May, and 89.3 in Bridgeton. WHYY-FM, member-supported public media for Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Jersey Shore.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about fear of intimacy with Dr. Lisa Firestone. She's Director of Research and Education for the Glendon Association, where she studies couples and family relationships. Our intern, Emily Haas, recently asked folks along Independence Mall whether they had ever been in a relationship where they or someone else had fear of intimacy. Let's listen.
My assumption is all relationships have some part of fear of intimacy, at least initially, and fear of commitment. I think it's just comfort level as far as that. When you first meet somebody, for example, if you meet somebody at a bar, then you're probably going to be a lot more cautious than somebody you may meet at work that you've known for quite a while. I think it's just once you're comfortable, then all that stuff kind of goes away.
For me, myself, it's when the person that I was starting to date, they were sort of pushing me to commit a lot quicker than what I wanted to. And that would scare me and almost make me run away. And I think on at least one occasion I did.
There's things that get in the way. I don't know, I'm in college, so I'm not really looking for, like, marriage or anything. And I don't know, it's just hard to, like, take things seriously when you're in your 20s, I guess.
Fear of intimacy? Yeah, I think that probably the way I grew up, kind of I was in a family where there wasn't a lot of affection. Didn't even say, like, I love you very much. So it was just kind of weird to suddenly do that in a romantic relationship.
I've seen, you know, my mother go through certain things, and I've seen her get her heart broken and things like that. So I guess it kind of makes me nervous to take it to that next level.
Guys enjoy being single. I think relationships, you realize, are a lot of work. You have to really be committed to being in one. If you're not, then it's really not worth it. You really shouldn't bother.
Well, that's why you're in a relationship. You know, if you're going to be with a person, you might as well, you know, share everything or just don't have a relationship. As a matter of fact, I'm from New York. I'm here for work. I go home on weekends, and we're loyal to each other. We don't really worry about things like that. And it's great, because when I get home on weekends, it's almost like we're dating again.
You know, Lisa, many years ago, we had Deborah Lupnitz on our show. She's a psychoanalyst who wrote a book called Schopenhauer's Porcupines. And one of the things suggested is that, you know, we're like porcupines, and that, you know, porcupines, to stay warm in the winter, you know, they can't get too close to each other, or they'll get hurt, or they can't stay too far, they'll freeze to death. So, you know, intimacy is not a quantitative phenomenon, it's qualitative. Don't we have to find the right balance with our partner?
I think we do. I think, you know, that metaphor Schopenhauer's about the porcupines is really an apt one, that, you know, we're very social creatures and we want to be close to another person and share our life and have that companionship, but that we're also going to get hurt in our most intimate relationships, partly because we make ourselves the most vulnerable in those relationships. But, you know, if we feel, you know, solid in ourselves that, you know, yes, we're going to have hurts or, you know, that are going to happen in close relationships. But, you know, again, I think it comes back to the vulnerability issue. If we feel safe in being vulnerable and, you know, have faith in ourselves, then we can allow that vulnerability. And, yes, we're going to get hurt, but it's worth taking those chances and getting hurt.
Yeah, and you know what? You know, the fact of the matter is, you're right. When we're vulnerable, we can get hurt. And we're at risk for getting hurt. And I guess the more vulnerable we are, the higher the risk. But what somehow our brains don't hold on to the simple truth that every time in life we have been hurt, we have recovered. You know, we can only remember the times we've been hurt, but we can't remember that every time we've recovered. And if you can hold on to the truth that no matter what, you'll be okay, then it's kind of safer, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it really is. And you know, I think it has to do with developing a feeling about ourselves and really, you know, kind of living and being our adult real self as opposed to still feeling like a child that, it, you know, if we get left or abandoned, feels like you're not going to survive. Whereas an adult, if you're a whole person in and of yourself, you know, you don't have that feeling. But I think when we get into a fantasy bond or an illusion of connection, you know, losing that person feels like we're losing some part of ourselves because we've become so merged. And yet, you know, we really are separate, adult, whole human beings before this relationship, and will be,
exactly.
You know, even if it does come to an
exactly.
end.
Exactly. Let's go back to the lines. We've got Chris on the line. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Thanks so much for having the show. It's really great, and I love the word and the idea of intimacy. You asked about how some of your callers define it, and I define it as closeness. The closer you are, the more intimate you are. I wanted to ask you and Dr. Firestone what observations and tips I suppose you would give to people who are wondering about refreshing intimacy. You know, it's been my experience that I really wasn't prepared for the longevity of the relationship that I'm in with my wife of 20 years. I hadn't planned on being intimate for so long. I was just kind of not as thoughtful perhaps when I got married at 30 years old. It's been a long, nice marriage, but refreshing intimacy is an issue. And if you don't mind, I'm going to disconnect and listen to your comments off the air. But I want to say thank you.
You're welcome. And I also want to add to his comment, Lisa, before you answer that intimacy or closeness in a marriage really does wax and wane with every marriage, doesn't it?
Yes, I think it does, and especially for people who've been in long-term relationships. I've been married over 30 years now, and I got the chance to interview a couple who've been married over 50 years, and you know, they really talked about how, in a way, it's been a series of different marriages just within their marriage. And so I do think that there are periods of, more closeness and that waning. But I really think that the main thing that makes relationships lose their vitality over time is this forming of a fantasy bond or an illusion of connection. And so in terms of refreshing intimacy, I would really suggest looking for any ways that you've come to take each other for granted, that you've fallen into routine ways of relating where you're not really seeing the person anymore. It's just kind of the routine way of relating. Any ways you may have polarized where one person has sort of taken over certain responsibilities in the relationship and the other person does those things less. And really try to break some of those routines and, you know, really share activities that you both love and, you know, look for things that you can enjoy together so that there's aliveness and vitality to the relationship.
Mm. Tell us about mate selection. What goes into that?
Well, often we select people who in some way fit with our defenses, again, where in some way we're repeating our childhood, either in terms of them treating us like people did in our childhood. So in a way we're, quote, comfortable with those people. And often those people we have the most chemistry with at the beginning as well. But that often people are later on complaining about the exact same things they were drawn to in that person. Those are the problems they come into therapy for. So, you know, I think that often our selection process is distorted. And so if you see yourself having a series of relationships where similar issues have come up or similar problems, you can start to look at how you might be selecting those things and how people who don't have those issues may seem kind of boring to you or not that interesting, even though they may be the best potential partners for you.
Hmm. I had a woman many years ago who said to me about her husband, she said, you know, he's like a brick wall, and he's sitting on the other end of the sofa, and they're kind of back-to-back. He's like a brick wall. So later on in the session, we talk about why they married each other. So I said to her, so why'd you marry him? She said, oh, he was like a rock. And so what the hell's the difference between a rock and a brick wall? You know, it's just a bunch of rocks. That's all it is. But that really proves your point. That's exactly what happens.
Yeah, it's exactly what happens, and it's what people are complaining about. And, you know, it's how do you, you know, first of all, maybe select partners who are outside of your range of comfort, or how do you start, after you get in a relationship, do you start distorting your partner and seeing them more in terms of people from your past than how they really are? Or, if all else fails, provoking them to act like people from your past. you know, one thing we found in terms of the critical inner voice or negative thoughts about ourselves is we often end up provoking our partner to say the very same critical thoughts that we have toward ourselves. Then we fight it out with them. But when relationships break up, often we have to take back all those criticisms because we think getting rid of our partner will solve it, but it doesn't.
Yeah, it's like the geographic cure for alcoholism. Listen, I've got a question. I'd been rattling around in my head as I was preparing the interview. Here we are talking about intimacy and fear of intimacy, and I can hear all of now. I'm 65. I can hear all of my parents' generation saying, "Are you people crazy? I mean, what are you talking about? What's relevant here? You know, is that generation wouldn't have talked about that. It wouldn't have been an issue." Is that
well? I think that, you know, while marriages tended to stay together more, maybe at that point, that often people were living in two separate worlds. I don't think, like, for instance, that longevity of a relationship really, is the proof of its strength of the relationship or the amount of intimacy in that relationship. But I do think intimacy is something that people have always wanted, but that, you know, it may not have been framed in quite the same way or talked about in quite the same way.
Hmm. Unfortunately, we are out of time, and we're going to take a short break and come back, and we're going to be talking about the tragedy in Norway and how it's affected all of us. Lisa, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. I really enjoyed it.
Me too. She's the Lisa Firestone's Director of Research and Education for the Glendon Association, where she studies couples and family relations. She's the co-author of Conquer Your Critical Inner Voice, Creating a Life of Meaning and Compassion, and Sex and Love in Intimate Relationships. And you can follow her blog on psychology today. After our break, we're going to be talking with Catherine Van Wormer, who's at the University of Northern Iowa, and Dr. Jim Cohen, who's a local psychologist here, and we're going to be talking about what happened in Norway. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
More than half of the U.S. has been sweltering this week. It's the worst heat wave in over 15 years. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Heidi Cullen, climate research scientist and author of The Weather of the Future, about extreme weather and new climate normals. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Politics, family, finance, faith. Too often the conversations are limited to who we know. But in our fast-paced world, it's important to know the new faces at the table and the new ideas that could shape our lives. Whether it's immigration, politics, or parenting, we offer real conversation about real issues. Join us as we explore what's beyond the headlines on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Last Friday, we heard the news that a car bomb had exploded in the government center in Oslo, Norway. Soon after that, it was reported that a gunman had gone on a rampage on an island summer camp for youth. Today, the combined death toll has reached 98. Subjects been in custody. And we're all left kind of breathless and wondering about the perpetrator, his intentions, how to cope with this tragic news. And it's probably made all of us, or most of us, feel a bit more vulnerable. Joining us to talk about this is Dr. Jim Cohen. He's a clinical psychologist who specialized in post-traumatic conditions. He practices in Bucks County. He's been on the show before, and full disclosure, he's the husband of WHYY's Marty Moss Cohen. Jim, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Dan.
We're also joined by Catherine Van Wormer. She's a professor of social work at the University of Northern Iowa, Iowa, sorry. She worked in Norway for 2 years at a drug and alcohol program, and she recently blogged about the Norway tragedy for Psychology Today. Catherine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Before we talk about what's happened to us in this country with Jim, Catherine, I'd like to hear from you. Are you in touch with any of the people you've worked with in Norway and heard directly about what impact this is having on them?
Yes, I heard from the very five people I wrote to. They all wrote back. They used terms like heartbroken and horrible. Some of them were going to church. They were lighting candles. It was significant because they rarely go to church in Norway, and I noticed on Sunday on TV that the pews were filled with people. There's sorrow in the whole nation of Norway.
Are you getting any sense of shock, outrage?
It's more grief at this point. And of course, shock, yeah. The first letters came in, I said, I can't believe it. And I myself, knowing that country, I couldn't believe it. How could that happen? And how could somebody who was brought up in that wonderful country, and I want to say it's a totally child-centered society, more so than any other place in the whole world. So the grief would be that much greater because they love their children. Everything is centered around their children. Independence Day is a march of all the children in Norway with their teachers. And they wear their national costumes. Instead of military, they honor their children on that day. And the schools are all set up to keep the stress low for the children. Hardly any grading that they do. They keep the same teacher for about 6 years in elementary school. I mean, everything is set up. So the grief would be overwhelming for the children who are lost, even by people who didn't know personally.
So what impact has this had on you?
I've been sad for just feeling this sense of sadness because I've written about Norway. This is utopia, if there could ever be a place like that. They're number one on the human development scale. And so I've been left with such warm feelings about my life there. And to see this happen, it's like, oh, everything's going to be ruined. Their trust is going to be gone. But they're holding together very well. They're focusing. They have this term, samarbeid, and the SAM means together. And everything, they speak with one voice almost. And they're holding firm with that tremendous togetherness. I looked it up in the dictionary, and there are dozens of words in Norwegian that start with sam, meaning together. And so you can see that. The king and queen were sitting there crying at the service that they had in Oslo. It would be like... This feeling will be within the whole country right now. But everybody will know somebody personally because if they lost 90-something people out of a country, I'm trying to think if they're up to 4 million, and especially people in the Labour Party, they would be very inclined, and that's the ruling party in Norway, they would be inclined to know people. And the ones who wrote me said that they didn't know anyone who died, but they knew... the parents of children who were there, and they found that they were all right. And so they were, very relieved to find that.
Jim, I wonder, talking about the impact on the people, does it vary depending on whether it is a natural disaster, like what happened in Japan versus what happened in Norway? Is that going to have a different impact on people?
Sure. Because depending on the culture and the context, having a willful decision to be that violent and cruel and inhumane is much more frightening in a certain sense than accepting the statistical risk of being in a situation where something goes wrong. So the more personal it feels and the more intentional it feels, the more anxiety it is. So when children get traumatized by their parents, it's very different than when they're in a situation where, say, a house fire or something like that.
Jim, as long as we're talking with you, I'd like to understand what happens to us as we, you know, we can not identify with it, but, I mean, it opens our hearts about what happened over there. And for me personally, it did increase my sense of vulnerability. So what's the impact of hearing these stories? And I, you know, we hear them almost every day now. You know, it's not, maybe not to this extent, but, you know, we hear Norway, we hear Japan, and you know, these tragedies that leave us all so vulnerable. What happens to us?
Well, I think there's a mixed phenomena. The fact that it was in Norway and not in New York like 9/11, people defend themselves differently. They actually distance themselves a little more. The media covers it differently. I promise you, if that same event took place in the United States, it would have been the 24/7 story. Mm-hmm. And I'm not criticizing that. I think that's natural. You know, there's a sort of carryover from your previous segments about intimacy, which also suggests the issue of empathy. And to the degree that we're intimate is also measured or facilitated by how empathic we can be. So it takes a little more effort and a little more courage and vulnerability to more completely empathize with people in Norway than in the United States, because we need to transcend our tribal, local cultural dynamics and truly feel the universality of what it is to be human. And we defend against that. That's how we survive. The closer our neighbors are, the more they're like us, the further away. So I think the media facilitates this empathy sometimes, because we get this immediacy. We get pictures and stories and sound. On the other hand, it helps us defend, because it triages what we know, what we don't know, and how we interpret it. I think that we feel like there's more of that going on because of this technology, that we get immersed in it more, but I think it has a mixed effect.
Yeah, I do too, and I think our first reaction, and I'm curious about, you know, here versus Norway, but certainly our first reaction in this country is to find out the perpetrator, go after him or her, put them away, psychoanalyze them on every media possible, and then we're done. And then we can feel safe again, or have the illusion right of safety, rather than to open our hearts to those who suffer.
Yeah, the sadistic motivations of this individual, regardless of all the other details, was to go after essentially the most vulnerable people in a society in this horrifically indifferent way, and that's what hurts us even more, because we can't in any way justify, you know, when soldiers are in war or policemen are in situations, or when we're in situations where people willingly get themselves into danger, we can process it in some way, maybe unfairly, but we do. But when children are destroyed like that, particularly with this enormous bias toward a particular group, it is frightening to know that other human beings can be this vicious.
Catherine, I'm curious about the reaction of the people in Norway. Is there a sense of aggression and rage towards this man who was the perpetrator?
Well, there's bound to be. I imagine more will come out later. But Norway is a non-punitive society. The maximum sentence they have there is 21 years in prison. Mm. And they just don't react quite with the aggression like you would expect so much in America with, oh, let's get revenge. And so what they're saying is, we won't let this cause us to lose our trust or our freedom. That's a reaction that's happening now, that seems to be a lot stronger. Now, they didn't let him make his statement in court today. He was going to make this long speech. They closed it to the public deliberately so that he could deny him with that for that. But the punitive response so far doesn't seem to be there so much.
Hmm. Was he able to make his speech in court?
I think he just made it briefly, but it was behind closed doors.
Yeah.
But he's issued 1,000 pages of documents that people are reading, but they're not reading it for the purpose that he wants them to.
This xenophobia that he apparently had is his fear of the kind of Muslimization of, I think that's his language, Muslimization of Europe. Is that a sentiment in Norway? Is that a small minority, or is it increasing?
No, that is a sentiment. Because they're such an open country, they don't believe themselves. They act like they don't feel superior to people in other lands. Modesty is such a part of their culture. So they've been relatively open to immigrants coming in, and a lot of those immigrants have been Muslims from Pakistan. And I was talking to a friend a few weeks ago, and the people there are very worried about their culture and losing their culture, but nothing like this. I mean, they're not blaming the individual people, but there is a political backlash, and there's a political party. It's an anti-immigrant party, and that was the party that this individual had been a member of. But nobody there believes in violence. They just wanted to preserve the culture for the Norwegians, some of these people. And they're concerned about the crime rate going up and that kind of thing.
And that gets attributed to immigrants.
Well, it had to do with different values of people coming in. Some of the people from Europe, from some of the Bosnians, it looked like there was an increase in theft and... they had buildings they left unlocked out in the country, and they say today they're going to have to find a way to lock them up because some of the newcomers, they had different values, and they would go out there and just, I guess, move in these empty houses.
Yeah, that sounds very similar to what's going on in our country now, the struggle over immigration, how to deal
mm-hmm.
with it, and the pull of the two political parties. And I think some of that pull is legitimate, but Jim, what's the birthplace of the xenophobia?
This tribal notion that we're safer if we are around people like us and more at risk when they're different, even if we risk hurting or abusing actually potentially friendly different others. It's a friendly fire issue. We'd rather hurt people who are innocent rather than risk a so-called dangerous person coming in. It seems to me, from what I know about the Norway story, that the vulnerability now for the PTSD there has to do with their special forces and police. They didn't really live up to the promise that they would show up on time and be present and effective. There was some breakdown there. I'm not blaming anybody, but I think that is probably going to have an effect on the culture of feeling like somehow they've neglected their own safety by minimizing the risk, even though this was probably an extremely rare possibility. Because people look for those things in an analysis of their safety, and they look for that weak link. And I suspect in this case it's going to be more about that.
Catherine, what are your thoughts about that?
Oh, that's a good point. If that had happened in America, the police would have been there within minutes. And I understood it took them 40 minutes, maybe longer, to get there. And it was only 60 miles or less from the big city of Oslo.
Hmm.
Part of the reason might have been that 2 hours before that, there was the huge bombing. And I think the whole country and all the security forces were centered on Oslo.
That must have been his plan as well.
Mm-hmm, it could have been, because he worked it out for years and years. Whatever the reason, I'm sure there'll be blame there. You know, where was the protection? But they're such an innocent nation, they don't have high security because they haven't had problems like this in the past.
I hate to ask you to predict the future, Catherine, but will this nation remain will this nation remain as they are, or will this change them fundamentally?
That's what I'm worried about. They're really trying to say we're going to stay the same, but I think that they will have more security. I hope the police won't get armed, but you know, there's going to be a movement that way. It might end up strengthening the right wing rather than the left wing.
Yeah, it's tragic and it's heartbreaking. And however it unfolds, I unfortunately we have to end. I want to thank you both for coming on at such very very short notice. I appreciate your flexibility. Thank you, Jim.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Catherine.
Good to talk to you, Dan.
Bye bye.
Bye.
We have been talking about the tragedies in Norway, where 98 people were killed. We learned about that on Friday. I was talking with Dr. Jim Cohen. He's a clinical psychologist who specializes in post-traumatic conditions, and he practices in Bucks County. We also heard from Catherine Van Warmer, professor of social work at the University of Northern Iowa, and she worked in Norway for 2 years, and she recently blogged about the tragedy for Psychology Today. Earlier on, we heard from Dr. Lisa Firestone about issues of fear of intimacy. Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll hear from gay couples and their lives together in light of the possibility of gay marriage kind of sweeping the country, or the hope of it. If you've got a question, show idea, or comment, you can email us at voices@whyy.org, and I can be reached at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Kevin Griffin. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lind is our producer. Our interns are Emily Haas and Evan Pliss. And me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.